Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, and I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Kevin DeBose. If you haven't listened to the earlier episode with Kevin, go back and find that. It's got a lot of great information about Kevin, his background, and just tons of great information about both trial and appellate practice. We brought Kevin back today to talk about a little bit more specific topic, and that is the Texas standards of appellate conduct. And Texas is pretty unique because we do have separate standards of appellate conduct that are different from the disciplinary rules that apply to all lawyers. And Kevin is one of the people that was around and helped develop these. So we wanted to bring him back as he's kind of the resident expert on these to give it a little bit more depth and talk about them. So welcome back to the show, Kevin.
Thanks. Great to be back. It's been a long time.
I mentioned before we started recording that Kevin is our second repeat guest. So we're very glad to have you back. But we did feel like this topic really warranted its own episode. So we're thrilled to have you here to talk about this very important topic.
One of my favorite subjects.
Well, there was a time before the standards for appellate conduct. If I remember correctly, the document, more or less in its form now, was adopted in about the mid-90s sometime. So has it been 25 years?
It was adopted in 99. We started working on it in the summer of 95. So we sort of called this the 25th anniversary of the beginnings of the standards. But yeah.
So tell us about what really drove the origination of this. I've really never known. I know what you say it was adopted in 99. I was a young lawyer in 99. I've really never known a life without the standards for appellate conduct. It was so early in my career. And I do remember, you know, way back when, this being talked about a lot at the CLEs. But tell us about the origination and the impetus for it.
Sure. Well, it really kind of started in the 80s with some problems in the trial courts in Texas. We began to see the proliferation of what people called at the time Rambo litigation tactics. You know, there'd always been a certain amount of this ever since there'd been lawyers, but there was one particular firm in Dallas that really not only embraced a very combative, abusive, intimidating style of trial litigation, but used it as a marketing tool and told their clients, you know, if you want the meanest, baddest sons of bitches on the street to fight for you, hire our firm. And some lawyers began to be concerned about that and got together and started working on what became the Texas Lawyers Creed. I think Justice Eugene Cook, who was on the Texas Supreme Court at the time, was sort of the driving force behind it. He formed a bipartisan committee and wisely appointed co-chairs, one from the defense bar and one from the plaintiff's bar. The defense lawyer was a guy named Blackie Holmes from Dallas, and the plaintiff's lawyer was Fred Higgins from Houston. And they got together and created the Texas Lawyers Creed, which was adopted by the Supreme Court in 1989. And when that happened, I talked in my previous visit about the 87 being a watershed year for the appellate bar, because it's the first year that we had the certification exam, the advanced appellate practice course, and the formation of the state bar appellate section. So we were new and just kind of trying to establish our identity. And I think in 89, or 90, I was the chair of something called the Appellate Professionalism Committee, or the Appellate Something Committee. And I remember on that committee, somebody said, well, this Texas Lawyers Creed has been adopted. It's obviously aimed at trial lawyers practice. Maybe we should consider something like that for appellate lawyers. And my first reaction at the time was, we don't need a creed like that. We don't behave like that. We don't have Rambo tactics in the appellate court. We're pretty well behaved and govern ourselves, and we don't need a set of standards to prove otherwise. But over the next several years, I started thinking about that more. And I in the early 90s, I started giving some CLE speeches, appellate ethics and professionalism, and wrote some articles. And I began to realize that even though generally our culture was such that appellate lawyers were more civil and friendly, there was some disagreement about what exactly we agreed on. And like, for example, one of the articles I wrote said you should never oppose somebody else's request for extension of time. And I had a very prominent lawyer kind of call me to task saying, oh, come on, Kevin, surely you don't think we should just roll over and let the other side have an extension. I said, well, yeah, I kind of do. So I realized there was some difference of opinion. But the two real driving forces behind it, the more I thought about it, were that was still back in the day when there weren't a whole lot of appellate specialists. A lot of trial lawyers argued their own appeal. And I thought trial lawyers need to know when they come into the appellate courts, different culture, different landscape. And if they come in the appellate courts and throw their weight around like they do in the trial courts, they're not going to be very well received. And rather than them get ambushed, we ought to warn them. But the other thing, and this may have been a more important factor, is clients who are used to litigating in the trial courts kind of expect their appellate lawyer to have the same attitude and same conduct. And we need something to be able to show our clients, this is not what the courts want. So when I became chair of the appellate section in 95, 96, I formed a committee to look into the creation of what I think I was then calling the appellate lawyer's creed. And the best thing I ever did was to appoint Skip Watson as chair of that committee. And I don't even think I knew Skip that well at the time. He was practicing Amarillo, and I'd met him in some appellate functions, but I really didn't know him very well. And boy, what an inspired choice that is. We've become really close friends over the years since then, and I've really come to appreciate Skip. And at the end, remember to ask me for an appellate story or anecdote, because I have a great one about Skip. And then we formed a committee, which I'd sent out an email. I'd set up four committees, and I sent out an email to the appellate section saying, if you want to be on one of those committees, let me know. And I had several people volunteer for this committee, and I don't remember if it was all made up of volunteers or if I handpicked anyone other than Skip, but it was a really good cross-section. We had Justice Eugene Cook, who by then was a former Supreme Court justice. He was practicing at Bracewell, but he had retired from the court. And because of his experience with Texas Lawyers Creed, he was invaluable to us. And then we had a current sitting appellate justice, Ann McClure from El Paso. We had a staff attorney from the Austin Court of Appeals, Jesse Amos, who later moved to Houston in private practice and then went back for one of the Houston Courts of Appeals. Recently retired. We had David Gunn, appellate practitioner in Houston, then a very young appellate practitioner. And we had Steve Tatum from Fort Worth with Canning Hanger, who I think is still with Canning Hanger. We had a guy named David Hrisik, who was with Baker Botts, who now has been a professor for the last 15 or 20 years at Mercer University in Atlanta. And a guy named Shane Sanders, who was from Bryan College Station. He's now in Waco. So that was our committee, and we got together and started talking about these drafting something, which Skip pretty early on said, I don't think we need another creed, but I'd like to call them standards for appellate conduct. And the first thing that he did for and we met several times over the next year in person before Zoom. We met in Austin, and we came from around the state. And Skip started off by talking about what causes people to act unprofessionally. And it was his thesis that the problem is that we have competing duties, that lawyers tend to get wrapped up in this duty to zealously represent clients. And we do have a duty to our clients, but we also have a duty to the courts. We have a duty to the other lawyers. We felt like courts have a duty to the practitioners. And we had a really fascinating discussion about how these duties interact. And we also started, Gene Cook brought to the first meeting two banker's boxes of standards and creeds and rules from all over the country. There were 40 different jurisdictions that had rules that we studied, but we looked at them and began to realize that none of them focused on appellate practice. They were all mainly about trial practice. And that became all the more important to us to craft something that would work for an appellate practice. So we read the standards, we thought about the different duties, and Skip suggested that we structure the standards along the lines of those competing duties. And we made initial drafting assignments. Skip drafted the preamble, which was really important because it talked about this conflict of duties and how we need to balance the duties, but really well-written, eloquent preamble. Then we had four sections, lawyers' duties to client, lawyers' duties to other lawyers' duties to the courts, and the courts' duties to lawyers. And we drafted them, we circulated the drafts, we circulated edits, we got together and hashed them out in person and literally kind of went over them sentence by sentence. and talked about what sounded good, what needed to go, what was superfluous. Really a fascinating group editing project. And everybody pulled their weight. There wasn't a leader or somebody that distinguished themselves from the crowd. And it was the only, I set up four committees. It was the only one I insisted. And I worked along with everybody else. And it took a year to finish the initial draft of the standards. And we assumed then we were pretty close to being home. It took us another 3 years to get them adopted by the courts. I won't go into all the difficulties that we had, but just of interest, one of the things that happened is we wanted to go to the courts and propose this. And we mentioned it to the state bar. We were just functioning as the appellate section of the state bar. And the appellate section, the state bar, the big bar, as Skip calls it, was really upset that we had undertaken this effort without asking them for permission. They said, you know, you really don't, this is not something you have the power to do. You should have asked us. And we're not sure if we're going to let you go forward. We had several strong advocates. Richard Orsinger was the chair the year behind me. And Richard was a longtime member of the State Bar Executive Board and knew a lot of people and knew who to talk to and strings to pull. But the bar insisted on some changes. We circulated drafts to every judge in the state, both appellate and trial judges, 100 appellate judges, and I think several hundred state court, district court judges. Got some feedback, most of it favorable, got some suggestions that we made to tweak things. The only thing we really got much pushback on was the section that we called the court's duties to lawyers. And the courts were really not very comfortable with a group of lawyers getting together and telling them what their duties to lawyers are. So we ended up changing the name of the last section to the court's relationship with counsel rather than the court's duties to lawyers. But it went through the judges. Then we got to the Supreme Court. Skip Watson had some meetings with people on the court. Deborah Hankinson was on the court, and she turned out to be a huge advocate of this process. And she went around, apparently talked to the judges one by one, both on the Supreme Court and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and would not stop until she got everyone's agreement. So February 1st, 1999, the standards were promulgated jointly, the Texas Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals, thereby making us the first jurisdiction in the country to have standards of conduct specifically designed for appellate courts, and to this day, the only jurisdiction. I've had several people from other states talk to me about this and ask for a copy and ask me how we did it and say, boy, I'm going to go do that in my state. It's never happened.
I was going to ask you that question.
I was too.
It's been around for 20 years in its official form now. And, you know, we all know that our state and our court system and our bar is an example to many other states, you know, at the equivalent levels of institutions. And so we're used to taking a leadership role in this kind of thing. And I'm just floored by the fact that no one else has adopted it. And that it includes other jurisdictions that have board certifications, you know, that would Florida, California, Louisiana now. That just blows me away.
That is pretty amazing that nobody has done anything like this.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
I'm a member of an organization called the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers, and it's kind of surprising how many states now have a very well-developed appellate bar. In fact, the ones that don't are kind of the exception. New York still doesn't, Massachusetts still doesn't, but a lot of states do. And Skip and I did a presentation, I think in 2016, we met in San Antonio, and Skip and I did a presentation on the standards. And a lot of people were very interested and came up, talked to us afterwards and asked for copies. No one's gotten it done. Skip says that it's because the stars aligned over that several year period, that and Deborah Hankinson pushing it and a few other people that got it done, but it may never get done again. It's extraordinary.
Well, we're going to do our part to promote the standards and among other states as well. We're going to send this out on social media. And
that's right.
Maybe we'll shame our brothers and sisters in other states into following this, that Texas lead on this.
Yeah. You know, at the time, and I've always said that we didn't undertake this project to change the appellate culture, but to reflect it and to communicate to clients and other lawyers who aren't yet used to the appellate courts what it is. None of us had done anything like this before. We didn't know what we were doing. And I think we ended up doing something rather extraordinary and rather bold, because it's not just the only one of its kind. I think it goes farther than any other ethical rules in really pushing a pretty hard line on professional conduct. And I'll go through with you some of the, I've compared our standards to the Texas disciplinary rules of professional conduct, which are not that different from the uniform rules. So this is what most states have. For example, the whole concept of balancing competing duties are the whole basis for the standards. And you don't see anything about that in the Texas disciplinary rules. They say we've got a duty to zealously represent our clients, but it really doesn't talk about balancing duties at all. Our standards say that when you accept an engagement, you can't accept something that you don't have a good faith belief is either that you have a chance of winning or that under existing law or good faith belief that law can and will be changed. The rules merely say that you can't accept a case if it's frivolous. And frivolous is defined as meaning that it requires you to make false statements of fact. So under the disciplinary rule, you can take a case as long as it doesn't require you to make known false statements of fact, you can take it. Whereas the standards say that you have to have a good faith belief that you can prevail. I recently did an ethical appellate ethics presentation in a national meeting, and I had a hypothetical. And one of the points we were making was there's a lawyer who is approached about a case. He looks at it, says, you don't have a chance of winning. I don't even think you're right. And the client says, well, yeah, but I need to file the appeal for settlement leverage with the other side and to buy some more time so I can decide whether I want to file bankruptcy. And the lawyer accepts the case. And my point was that's clearly unethical. And a number of lawyers from other states said, well, you can take the case. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. And under our standards, there is. Our standards are really good about not just saying, here's how you need to act, but here's what you need to tell the client up front when you take the engagement. Let me go through a list here, bullet points. You have to tell the clients that the standards exist and what they require. You have to tell the client about the fee agreement and the cost expectations. You have to tell them about the nature of the appellate process, the range of potential outcomes, the timetables, the effect of the appeal on the existing judgments, the availability of alternative dispute resolution. You have to talk to them about the expectation of proper behavior, civility, and courtesy, the attorney's right to agree to reasonable requests by opposing counsel. You have to tell them that up front, not wait till it comes up. You have to tell them that an appeal should only be pursued with a good faith belief that error was committed and that the attorney will not take frivolous positions in the appellate court. And I don't know any other standards or rules that require that. The disciplinary rules merely say that you need to keep clients informed during the representation of things as they come up. But the appellate standards say that you have to tell them all this stuff up front, which I think is really good policy. When it comes to behavior towards opposing counsel, the disciplinary rules say that you should avoid dishonesty, deceit, fraud, misrepresentation, and the obstruction of justice. That's a pretty low bar. Whereas our standards say that you should practice civility, courtesy, decorum, integrity, respect, and avoid personal attacks. So again, that's just a much higher standard than saying, don't be a liar and deceitful and fraudulent. In terms of the client's ability to dictate the behavior of the lawyers, the rules say that you have to abide by the client's instructions. The standards say that the client can't dictate how the lawyer behaves, and the lawyer reserves the right to grant reasonable requests of other lawyers. Finally, towards the courts, the rules say that you should refrain from conduct intended to disrupt the proceedings. Again, that's a pretty low bar. Whereas the appellate standards say that your behavior towards the court should exemplify professionalism, respect, integrity, civility, those kinds of things. So those are six different things that I think are really critical where our standards go way beyond what the rules of disciplinary conduct require. So for that reason, I think it's a really bold, almost even revolutionary statement. And the fact that our courts have embraced it and required it, I think is just a wonderful statement about our appellate courts.
It is. And I think to your point, it really does inform the culture of appellate lawyers in Texas. I mean, we have what is a fantastically collegial appellate bar throughout the state. And I think that this has a lot to do with it because the people that go into this role and do this, you know, for most of their full time live by these standards. And you can tell just in the way that they interact with one another and the courts and all that, it does make a huge difference. And when you have someone on the other side that is not an appellate lawyer, I think it's when you see these not being applied quite so faithfully. At least that's been my experience.
I was interested in what you said about the fact that these really reflected the culture at the time, rather than being intended necessarily to change the culture. That goes back again to what Jody was saying and what you said earlier, Kevin, about, you know, this being the type of relationship that appellate lawyers tend to have with each other. And of course, the influence on the court as well. But I was going to ask you before you said that about this being reflective, you know, what impact you had seen in the last 20 years of having the standards out there on the culture in the appellate bar?
Well, I think that it has helped sustain the culture that we already had and made it even better. I think a lot higher percentage of lawyers practicing in the appellate courts today are appellate specialists rather than, you know, in 1987 when the tide first started to turn. And having more appellate lawyers mean you have more people that are familiar with these standards. On the other hand, I don't know that I've seen the conduct change, but I think the awareness of the standards has changed some because they first were promulgated. It was big news and people talked about it a lot. The committee split up and went around and talked to every appellate court in the state with one or two members of the committee sitting down in person and talking to courts. I talked to one of the Houston courts. I talked to the Beaumont court. And had a really nice visit, and we talked to them about what we wanted, why we did the standards, and what we hoped they would accomplish. And the courts were very receptive, but that made them really aware of them. It was before we had much of an electronic presence in our practice. So we printed up a bunch of trifold pamphlets and passed them out. Every court we went to, we brought a box. And for a while, every time I went to an appellate court clerk's office, when you walked in the clerk's office, somewhere near the desk, there was a stack of pamphlets of the standards of appellate conduct. And they also, because they were a tripartite fold, they fit inside a letter size envelope. So every time I mailed an engagement letter to a client, back when we did mail engagement letters, I stuck that pamphlet in there. So, and I think people looked at it and it did create a heightened awareness. Today, most of our engagement letters are sent electronically. Todd, you were mentioning earlier that you always attach a copy. I think we should. We might try to change that. What we do now is in our engagement letter, there's a link to the standards. And in the letter, we say we are bound by the standards and you agree to allow us to be bound by the standards. And here's a link to them. But I think it's much more powerful to have a physical, like hard copy rather than hope that somebody won't follow the link. And, you know, now instead of being in pamphlets in the clerk's office, they're on the court's website, along with many, many other things. Some of the websites, it's kind of hard to find. I've looked for them before and been frustrated. So, and I think people just don't talk about them as much. And they've come to either take them for granted, or it may be that some of the younger appellate lawyers that have started practice in the last 5 or 10 years may not even be aware of them. So I'm hoping that between this podcast and Skip Watson and I recently did a presentation at the UT Law Appellate course, I hope that people will start talking about them again and, you know, maybe revisit them, see if there are new things we should add and amend them. But I would like to see more of an awareness of the standards. I think that the urgency of the awareness has decreased over time, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see it pumped up again.
Say, you know, reading so many of them are still good. One place where we might want to revisit is you can't manipulate margins or type size to avoid page limits. That's one that could be tweaked for now, but you know, these really are great and they're sort of evergreen standards because they're things that, you know, even as the practice of law has changed over the last 20 years, the duties really haven't changed and fit perfectly well with the kind of weird remote practice that we've all had for the last 3 months even.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly. And Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help.
As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
We could probably do a whole show on each of these four pillars within the standards themselves and really expand upon each one of those a lot. You know, as you point out, do attach a copy of these to my engagement agreements with clients because I want them to know they exist and I want them to know that this is the culture of my practice and this is how I'm going to conduct myself. If I ever do get pushback on acting in accordance with the standards, it's easy for me. I can go back and refer back to the standards and say, remember when we talked about this? And remember when I said, this is how my practice is operated? It really helps to cut off a lot of that debate about someone wanting me to be, you know, more aggressive and opposing a motion for extension of time or something like that, because that's expressly dealt with here in the standards. You're not to oppose good faith requests for extensions. And truthfully, we all know, I mean, we talked about it a fair amount on the show over several episodes. I mean, extensions are just necessary and balancing your workload as an appellate lawyer. And you have to get out of that. If someone is not in this practice area regularly, you've got to get out of that trial lawyer mentality when it comes to giving, you know, any ground at all on any issue. This is just something that, you know, we all get along. And I know the courts really appreciate that about our bar. That is one of the challenges when a client is coming out of a trial where their trial lawyer has been just, you know, beating the other side up one side and down the other at every turn, you know, to turn around and suddenly, you know, have this sort of dispassionate view of things. A lot of clients are initially sort of, they don't really know how to deal with that. And it's nice to have this document to be able to point them to and say, not only do we act in accordance with the rules of disciplinary conduct, that's sort of the floor, you know, our practice, our bar, this is really what we expect of each other. It's what the courts expect of us. And it's one of the things to me that makes our practice area great.
Yeah, I'm really proud to be a part of that culture, but I'm especially proud to have written confirmation of it. It's one thing to just have a warm, fuzzy feeling towards each other. Mm-hmm. But when we can look at this on paper or on a screen and say, you know, we agree on these things and the courts have endorsed it. That was a big, we couldn't just have this come from appellate lawyers and not have the backing of the courts, because that's really what counts with the clients, where you can say, it's not just that I'm a nice guy and I don't want to do this. The courts don't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. And here's where they said that. And that really is important. Now, on the other hand, I learned the hard way that I still talk to my clients before I agree to an extension. I once agreed to one without telling the client, and the trial lawyer didn't fire me, but talked about it and said, don't ever agree to anything like this without asking me again. Now, the hard part comes when you ask them and they say no, then you really lean on them hard. And I have, I think, always been able to convince my clients eventually. You know, I might even threaten to withdraw representation if they insisted on doing things like that. But mm-hmm. I find that most people agree that these ought to be the rules. I think the place, the opportunity for growth in the practice is interpreting them. I find that some people, myself included, on first drafts, can be a little bit snarky. Mm-hmm. You think, well, you know, I'm just being an advocate. And one thing my firm is really good about is every brief we file, we circulate to at least two or three other lawyers. And hopefully one lawyer who hasn't done any work on the case who's coming to it fresh. And one of the things we do for each other is dial back the snarkiness. Because a lot of times when you're saying it, you're not even aware. Mm-hmm. And disrespectful and snarky, but it's easy to slide into that. But whenever I'm called on it, I dial it back and say, no, I don't want to do this.
Yeah, we do it exactly the same way. We always have two or three people read through it for that exact reason. You just, sometimes your tone does not sound that way in your head, but to somebody who's neutral on it, looks at it and says, wait a minute.
Yeah.
And you can always tell which briefs have not had that done. It's kind of like that email that you write when you're angry and then just delete, but they'd never actually delete it if they went ahead and hit send on it.
Yep.
The catharsis draft makes it through.
Well, I think it's super useful for the folks that practice in our area of law and the trial lawyers to hear this perspective. I think it's impressive that 20 years after the approval, you can still give a CLE talk on this and do it. It's great that you can do it from the personal experience of having been involved in the creation and the drafting and seeing this all the way through that four-year process that one wouldn't have imagined would have been necessary. And now I've got this vision in my head of Justice Hankinson, you know, taking the document and walking it around the court, which that's really great too. So we're kind of at the end of our time today, Kevin. I don't want to interrupt you. Is there anything else about the standards that you wanted to cover today?
No, I think I've covered them. I encourage everybody to read them again, even if you've read before. It's always good to go back and touch base on them. But it's really one of the things in my career that I'm most proud of.
Well, you should be. I'm not going to let you get out of here, though, without telling your Skip Watson war story. we need to hear that.
Absolutely.
It's not really a war story. It's kind of the opposite of war. You know, like I said, Skip and I worked on this together and we've become really good friends. And I was asked to interview him for the appellate section's oral history project, where we interview all of the former chairs of the section. And I interviewed him for about an hour, and we got near the end of the hour. And I don't think this was even a response to a question, but Skip turned to me and said, "You know, Kevin, opposing counsel is not your enemy. It's just another professional trying to do their job to represent their client the best they can. Just because we have an adversary system, we don't need to be adversarial towards each other. Adversary system just means people on both sides get to present their positions as best they can for someone else to decide it, but it doesn't mean we need to be adversarial." And that was maybe 10 years ago. I don't know that I'd ever heard anyone say that before. I mean, the very first sentence that he said was, "Opposing counsel is not your enemy." My first thought was, "What do you mean?" But I've tried to live by those words ever since. And I repeat that story whenever I can, because that to me really is the fundamental part of the problem. Is we do tend to regard, we lawyers, not necessarily appellate lawyers, tend to regard the other side as the enemy, and they're not. And as long as we can hold on to that, it helps us with almost every decision.
Mm-hmm. It's very true.
Not a war story. It's a non-war story.
It's a peace story. Where I tend to see that exemplified is when I've got a good appellate lawyer on the other side of a case, and we've gone and we've argued the case to the court. You know, being able to come away from the argument, reach across and shake hands with opposing counsel, and really have that feeling of there being no animosity at all. It's everyone's just arguing their positions and representing their clients. And you know, kind of like the stories you hear about the old days, being able to then go out and have a beer after an argument. It's really one of the things that makes our bar special.
Yep.
And so thank you for all your work on helping to capture that as it existed back in the 90s and make sure that today we have the benefit of this document to help guide us in our decisions and, importantly, in our relationships, you know, not only with each other, but with our clients and with the court.
Absolutely.
It's a great opportunity to have. Awfully glad I found myself in that position.
Well, before we go, we'd like to take just a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. If you're looking for a sophisticated online research platform or for help with a supersedious bond, check out our post on this episode at techsapplawpod.com for more information about Thomson Reuters and CSBA.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at techsapplawpod.com or on Twitter at @techsapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.